Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In New York City, a man named Michael Tyson, not the boxer, became the first person to die from COVID-19 at the Rikers Island Jail in April of 2020. He had been incarcerated for 2 months. The reason he was there? Missing appointments with his parole officer. Later that month, Raymond Rivera was the second person to die on Rikers Island from COVID-19. The reason for his nearly year-long stay at the facility? Again, a technical parole violation. Although these stories sound extreme, 25% of all people incarcerated in the United States are there because of parole violations, doing things like missing a check-in, failing to pay a fee, failing a drug test, or even just staying out too late or traveling without permission. Ironically, programs like parole and probation were invented to keep people out of prison, not to lock them back up. And although it might not always work that way, as public awareness and opposition to mass incarceration increase, correctional administrators are increasingly relying on what they call alternative models to mass incarceration, like parole and probation, also electronic monitoring and diversion programs. While politicians laud these so-called alternative models, criminal justice advocates say that in many cases they're just an extension of the punitive model that they seek to replace, and that private corporations are making big bucks in the process. So with me now are Bianca Tylek, Executive Director of the advocacy group Worth Rises, and Vincent Schiraldi, Co-Director of the Columbia University Justice Lab and former Commissioner of the New York City Department of Probation. Now, as many of you know by now, this segment is part of our series in partnership with the Green Space and Worth Rises about the business side of the prison industry. We're having these conversations on Mondays to preview Tuesday night Green Space panels on the same topic. They happen at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays, and you can sign up for tomorrow's on parole and probation by going to thegreenspace.org. So Bianca, welcome back, and Vincent, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Hi, Brian. Nice to hear you again.
Bianca, you write in the Worth Rises report on this issue that private prisons have been preparing the shift for decades. What's the shift, and how has the private sector been preparing for something that probably most of our listeners don't think of in terms of privatization, which is probation and parole?
Absolutely. So, you know, the conversation around criminal justice has now been going on for a few years, right? And over the course of the last few years, we've started to see bipartisan support for criminal justice reform and other sort of changes in the space. We're seeing new bills passed and all of that. And the question is, where is this going, right? There are a lot of folks who are starting to call for and recognize that the levels of incarceration that we have today are just not ethical, they're not sustainable, and it's clearly not a working system. And so the private corporations are starting to see this narrative and this truth revealed, and it's fearsome, right? It suggests to them their business in incarcerating people might be dwindling. And so we actually see that as the criminal justice reform movement has been advancing, private corporations gearing up for that shift. And so private prisons in particular, which were instrumental in paving the road towards incarceration, specifically around mandatory minimums and truth in sentencing laws and three strikes laws, have now been, over the last decade, spending millions and hundreds of millions of dollars, in the case of GEO Group, actually $1 billion, acquiring electronic monitoring companies, day reporting centers, residential reentry, halfway houses, all of these types of new correctional institutions that some are calling alternatives, but we know are recreating incarceration in our community.
Now, listeners, we invite your voices and your stories on this series every week. And so if you are currently on parole or probation or under community supervision or attended a diversion program or are monitored electronically, any of those, What is your experience with one of the so-called alternative models to incarceration, and how does it affect your life day to day? 646-435-7280. We also invite you to call if you ever had to go back to jail or back to prison because of a parole violation. 646-435-7280. What was the violation, if you want to say, and how did that upend your life? What do you think is fair in this regard? 646-435-7280. You can also call in if you're a parole officer or if you work in a diversion program. What are your experiences working in this space? Does it work from your vantage point as a parole officer, for example? Or do you see ways that it exploits people who had been incarcerated and needs to be reformed? Or maybe sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and you want to talk about that. 646-435-7280. Again, we invite your stories if you are currently on probation or parole or under community supervision, attend a diversion program, or are monitored electronically. You can call if you were in the past as well and are now done with all that. What's your experience today? And people who work as parole officers or others in the system, again, also welcome to call 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. And as calls are coming in, Vincent Chiraldi, you formerly worked in New York City's Department of Probation. You know, for a lot of listeners who don't know, what's the difference between probation and parole?
Both of them were established in the 1800s during a time when the whole system was at least ostensibly built on rehabilitation. Penitentiaries were supposed to rehabilitate you. Probation and parole were focused on rehabilitation. Probation arguably was an alternative to getting locked up at a sentence that you get right when you're getting sentenced, and you'd be supervised by a probation officer instead of going to jail or prison. Parole was when you were already in prison and they were determining whether you should be released now or later, and they would evaluate how you did in prison. Did you, were you repentant? Did you go to programs? And then they'd release you. And then when they release you, somebody like a probation officer called a parole officer would supervise you on the streets when you came home.
To go a little bit more into the history, I think you tell a story of the year 1841, when a Boston bookmaker named John Augustus is thought to have founded the idea of probation. Who was he, and what was his motivation, if you want to tell that story, and does parole have a similar history?
Yeah, Augustus was, as you said, a bootmaker in Boston. He was a temperance movement guy. He was essentially in recovery. And he saw that these people were getting sent to jail, a house of corrections, for pretty low-level crimes, many financial crimes, public drunkenness, things like that. And he thought he could help. And so he started actually literally to bail people out. And he said, you know, worked it out with the judge. I'll bail you out. We'll come back in a period of time, generally a pretty short period of time. And if I can help this person turn their life around, don't sentence them to the house of correction. And that's what happened. Thousands of times over a 14-year period, he and his increasingly his colleagues in the temperance movement just volunteered, went to court, bailed people out, brought them back. Their lives were presumably changed, and the courts didn't lock them up. I think four times in those 14 years, the courts ended up locking somebody up for not doing well during the period of time they were being supervised. And that, you know, mushroomed within the beginning of the progressive era around the turn of the century. State after state after state started establishing probation by law. Now, parole, we're responsible here in New York for parole. It was initiated overseas in France and Australia and Ireland, and it was adopted by Zebulon Brockway, had great names back then, who was the brand new warden of the Elmira Penitentiary in 1876. He felt that people shouldn't just get a flat sentence and then be released from prison, but that they should sort of earn their way out of prison. And if they worked real hard, they should get out early. And but if they did get out early, they'd be out conditionally. Again, he would bring some volunteers to help observe them, support them, supervise them, and if they did well, they'd be released and then parole would end. And they call that parole. And that also spread around the whole country.
And as I read the history, at a certain point, the idea of rehabilitation became divorced from the idea of probation. First, a few Supreme Court cases diminished legal protections for people on parole and probation. And then there was a report put out by the city of New York called the Martinson Report. So tell us this history. Who was Robert Martinson, and how did he start to, quote, turn rehabilitation into a dirty word, as you put it, Vincent?
That's right. So two things kind of happened simultaneously. One was Richard Nixon and the Republican Party launched a Southern strategy to peel off Southern voters and Northern suburban voters from the Republican Party. They were reliably Democratic, and they felt that using the race issue would help peel some of them off. But they didn't overtly go after Black people. They tried to racialize both crime and poverty issues. Nixon famously launched the war on drugs in 1971. Starting in 1972, the prison population started rising and rose every single year until 2009, as Bianca mentioned. It was about a five-fold increase in the number of people in prison. If you go back to the 70s, we had about as many people per capita in prison as most European countries. Now we have generally about 5 to 7 times as many people. So it was a very successful, very terrible effort to increase mass incarceration. I'm not sure back in the 70s anybody ever thought it would grow that large
in terms of who's incarcerated. Let me play you, I know you're in the middle of the story, but I want to play a clip that I think our listeners will find very interesting that kind of illustrates this. It's of Robert Martinson, who ran that Martinson Report group for the city of New York. He's talking to 60 Minutes in this clip in 1977. The 60 Minutes segment is about how juvenile crime is way up in New York City, which the segment argues is because kids aren't facing harsh enough penalties. So here's a short clip of Robert Martinson. He says it's because
the juvenile justice system today does not do an adequate job. All these kids seem to know about the criminal justice system is that they're talked to. They're talked to by judges, by probation officers, by correctional counselors. What they really need, it seems to me, is certainty of being caught and certainty of being punished.
So put that into context for us.
And boy, did we get that certainty. Yeah. The number of people locked up, the number of people under supervision, mushroomed like no country in the history of the world. The Martinson releases this report out of the City University of New York, essentially says nothing works when it comes, or at least he frames it as saying nothing works when it comes to rehabilitating people. And the whole system pivots. Prisons start to become more punitive, but probation and parole start to emulate their big brother, the prison system. They start carrying guns, wearing flak jackets, handing out intermediate sanctions, putting people on electronic monitoring. And then this is kind of where it gets to Bianca's point, which is this happens at the same time when we're having tax revolutions and cutting taxes. Nobody wants to pay for all this probation, all this parole, all these prisons. And so we start to charge people under supervision. We start to privatize. We start to kind of milk the poor for the punishment we're meting out to them. And it sort of has disastrous consequences, which I'm sure the rest of the show is going to be about.
Let's take a phone call. Baxter on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Baxter.
How are you, Brian?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for receiving me. I have a very bad experience with parole and probation, very bad experience. These agencies should be coming under investigation by the Department of Justice. Pro is incompetent. They're very incompetent, sir. They're very incompetent. I have documentation, affidavits I can send to you so you can review what they've done.
What happened in your case?
In my case, they placed a violent charge on my record to hold me, extend my sentence. My sentence was 1 to 3, Brian, and they kept me another year on a bogus claim of homicide that occurred in 1975, which never occurred. You hear me good?
Mm-hmm.
They placed a homicide on my record and held me for a year on that homicide, that forced homicide charge. And I had to write to the commissioner at that time to get released. I was held a year, additional year, on the fourth charge, and parole appeal division say it was correct, and it was not correct. Even the Supreme Court in Queen County said the charge was false. So they didn't believe my word, and they held me another whole year. Parole is corrupt and criminal. They should be under investigation by the Department of Justice. They are terrible, Brian. They're terrorizing and torturing people. Information is no different. New York County Information Department in Bronx County is no different. Bracey also propositioned me sexually. He invited me to his penis while under his supervision.
Baxter, I'm going to leave it there. I appreciate your call. And, of course, we can't verify the allegations in his story, Bianca, but do some of the larger themes there ring true to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think whether it's, you know, corruption outright or corruption sort of in just how the system exists, I think it's important to understand, right? Like, as Vinny was sort of telling the story of how we've really co-opted and transformed different aspects of the way in which probation and parole have been intended to be used and where it is today, I think so much of that is shaped by the industry that decided to get involved. You know, what used to be something that, you know, was hopefully going to see people into a different path or support them into a different direction, we have seen really just about net widening people, net widening the system and capturing more and more people into it. And so, you know, we see, as I was explaining earlier, these major private prison corporations now moving into community corrections, specifically through things like electronic monitoring. The largest private prison corporation that we are familiar with in that context and from previous weeks, Geo Group, is in fact the largest electronic monitoring company in the country. And they're, you know, with other sort of comrades in the field like Tenti and Supercom and Securus, which also has an electronic monitoring arm, they are working to expand electronic monitoring, to claim that it's an alternative to incarceration. Let's be clear, it is just e-carceration. And so it's transforming our communities into carceral settings. But on top of that, and perhaps more importantly, electronic monitoring has never freed anybody. It has, in fact, expanded the number of people on supervision and correctional control. And so one of the things I just like to say is, you know, if the same people are at the table looking for solutions to mass incarceration that helped create it, it's probably not the table that's going to come up with the solution.
I see we have the director of an alternative to incarceration program calling in. And Edward in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in. Hi, Edward.
Hi. Good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to respond. I'm a forensic psychologist. I'm the clinical director of a program for alternatives to incarceration for clients that have substance use and co-occurring severe mental illness. And to your question that you said, what is the experience that I've had?
Mm-hmm.
So I work directly in Queens. With the district attorney's office there and defense bar. And I got to say that it's mixed. I think that the DA's office and defense bar do a great job of trying to work collaboratively in terms of identifying underlying conditions. But when we try to refer clients to programs in the community, that's where sometimes we will not have the appropriate resources to help our clients with the underlying issues that may have got them involved in the criminal justice system in the first place. So that's been my experience with our program. I believe in terms of recidivism rates, we've had about, I believe, 60 to 80%, which I think is average in terms of people that have completed our program and then are not incarcerated within a year of completing the program. But yeah, I just wanted to add that commentary. I do hear the other side of it, where it might feel to clients as if it's another form of incarceration, especially if it's something like sending a client to a residential treatment program. But I just wanted to add my thoughts in terms of the success and how it is working with the alternative to incarceration.
Edward, thank you very much. Bianca, I was surprised to learn that many diversion corporations partner with prosecutors' offices, who often receive a percentage of the fees paid by participants. Does that give them an incentive to push people into diversion programs?
Absolutely. And I think there's a really big difference between government-run diversion programs, nonprofit diversion programs, and for-profit diversion programs. And in the example that you're putting on the table, yes, there's actually a lot of companies, a good number, one called Corrective Solutions, that actually goes after people with low-level crimes who they think that they can who might be charged, who might not be charged, who they can convince a prosecutor to put into their program, which they have to pay for, and they will share some of those proceeds with the prosecutor's office. And it's not just that type of diversion program. There's actually diversion programs with major corporations like Exxon and Walmart, where people will be required to do unpaid work as their diversion program. And those are actually agreements between those corporations and often some kind of facilitator who might be a for-profit, might even be a nonprofit, and the prosecutor's office. So there's quite a number of diversion programs that are very clearly holding incarceration over people's heads.
Interesting.
To exploit them.
And Vincent, I want to give you the last word. A bill did just pass in New York to restore voting rights to people on parole. I think that's surprising to some people that you can't vote if you're still on parole, even though you've served your time behind bars. But I also know you're pushing for legislation in New York State called the Less is More Act. So in our last 30 seconds or so, I want to tell people what's in it.
Yeah, Less is More would substantially reduce the ability of parole to revoke people and send them to prison. But it would also, on the flip side, incentivize good behavior by giving people time off of supervision, reduce the amount of time you're under supervision by every month you behave well and don't get in trouble. Senator Benjamin and Assemblymember Forrest have promoted this. There's a wide range, over 150 organizations supporting it. There's 8 district attorneys. And that's step one for me. Step two is we have to capture the $680 million worth of savings from not revoking people and put it into the kind of programs that will help people turn their lives around.
Gotcha. Former commissioner of the New York City Department of Probation, now co-director of the Columbia University Justice Lab, Vincent Schiraldi, and Bianca Tylek, executive director of Worth Rises. And listeners, you can hear more on this topic from both of them and others in tomorrow's Green Space event on the topic. That's at 7 p.m. And you can sign up by going to thegreenspace.org. Meanwhile, Vincent and Bianca, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.